In any given week, there is bound to be at least one item of news that captures our attention. It may have failed to catch your eye, but had you realised that the Labour Party is in the process of selecting a new leader? Before I'm accused of any political bias, I should say that there are other political parties, and more locally, they're engaged in selection processes, but that's local politics. It may appear in the Dunfermline Press. I suspect not. And it's not the subject of intense scrutiny of the national media. Political journalists and others are busily weighing up the pros and cons of each candidate. Senior Labour figures have had their say. Some are continuing to do so this morning. The candidates themselves every so often offer some wisdom of what they might bring to leadership, and in the midst of all of that, there are the odd stories that suddenly appear that cause discussion to happen amidst those who are really only vaguely interested. In recent weeks, Yvette Cooper's potential has been questioned because she's married to Ed Balls. He's not who I thought he was, but I believe he doesn't carry the credentials that some would hope him to have. This week, Jeremy Corbyn, who has got the current Labour leadership in a panic because he may be left of centre, potentially scuppered his own chances by welcoming the suggestion of a return to women-only train carriages as a way to combat the rise in sex attacks on trains. Outraged women and men have decried the possible safety of such carriages, suggesting that they make women the potential harlots or sexual temptresses because they fail to make men responsible for their own actions, suggesting that men are naturally predators who cannot control their own behaviour. Perhaps you too were outraged. Maybe you're outraged this morning. Maybe you'll be outraged by the time we get to the end of the sermon. There's nothing like a little bit of outrage to have us clinging to our moral high ground. So where to begin with our outrage? Maybe you're outraged because you were here last Sunday and one of the readings is the same. Had you noticed? Was there not enough mention of love and lust last week? I mean, Jean went to town. And if you're not outraged by Song of Songs, then perhaps you can sense the multiple layers of outrage that are to be heard in the gospel. We're returning to the Revised Common Lectionary this morning, having spent the last 4 weeks looking at Old Testament wisdom and poetry. And what we have is two of potentially six readings that could have been selected this morning. Returning to Song of Songs, we're taking a different tack this morning and allowing ourselves to experience the outrage we are being invited to. It might be the Victorian buttoned-up outrage. It may even be Presbyterian outrage. As a church, given our sometime preoccupation with homosexuality, we are uncomfortable with talking about sexuality and sensuality, embarrassed by love poems. But Song of Song is more than a love poem. It's a call to love, just as we call a meeting to order, or the telephone calls us to a conversation, this passage calls us to love. It's a love that carries the marks of fidelity and mutuality, for in the Song of Songs, man and woman are equal in their partnership. If we allow allegory to take control, then there's the potential of discovering the intimate, passionate relationship that God seeks with his creation, with his people. It's a reminder of a longed-for relationship of mutuality where humanity not only loves God, but is in love with the divine. It's an outrageous, overwhelming, positive falling in love where each party is to enjoy the changing world around them, That outrageous outpouring of affection should send us to look at the wintered, desolate places of our world and ask how an outpouring of love might transform them. In the words of Alphonetta Wines, a Methodist pastor and a biblical scholar, in a day and time when music and movies simultaneously extol and exploit love distorted, abused and taken for granted, in a day and time when there are women's shelters to protect women and their children from domestic and or family violence, in a day and time when human and sex trafficking rivals the drug trade for illegal financial gain, in a day and time when headlines daily affirm that women around the globe are kidnapped, raped and disrespected, in a day and time such as this, we need to hear the Song of Songs. The Gospel of Mark carries none of the poetry of the Song of Songs, and yet it offers a call of love to wrestle with once we've played within the outrage of what we've heard. We're walking into the middle of an argument as we encounter the Gospel this morning. In the writer of Mark's brisk hurry to lead us to Jerusalem and the outrageous outpouring of love that happens within that city, he leads us at breathtaking speed through the events of Jesus' life. Always with an eye on what is to come, the writer drops in seemingly insignificant details that on closer examination remind reader and hearers of the bigger story of the possibility of the heavenly kingdom, of the possibility of resurrection and redemption. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law have journeyed from Jerusalem to meet Jesus. Jesus is not alone. Instead, he's surrounded by the crowd and the disciples are with him. The three-layer conversation that happens allows the message of the passage to resonate. The passage begins with the outrage of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. They have either heard or witnessed the behaviour of the disciples, and they've almost certainly heard that Jesus has been healing in the market. They've come from Jerusalem, so we are to know that the story is important. It connects to the death and resurrection. The Pharisees comment on the uncleanliness of the disciples as they eat. Trying to take the moral high ground, they suggest that the traditions of the elders are followed by almost all Jews. These traditions meant that there was a ritual washing that should have taken place before the disciples sat down to eat. But their questioning of Jesus also links back to chapter 6, where Jesus has been healing in the marketplace, and the implication is that Jesus himself is unclean. The Pharisees are suggesting that Jesus sees himself above or out with the law. Recognising what the Pharisees are up to, it's Jesus' turn to be outraged. He challenges their own practice of using and abusing law to justify their actions. In the section we didn't read, Jesus points out the hypocrisy of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law who use the practice of Corban, which is an offering that's set aside from earnings to go to the temple. By using that practice, adult children were able to step aside from their responsibility to care for their parents. And Jesus suggests that the practice goes against the commandment to honour your parents. The issue's about more than cleanliness of hands. Instead, Jesus turns to cleanliness of heart. In what Jesus says, the heart becomes the centre of will and rationality, the place from which our intentions rise. While Jesus closes what he says with a list of potential corruptions of the heart, he's already countered that list with the need to prepare hearts for service of God. In On Your Mark, reading Mark in the Shadow of the Cross, Megan McKenna writes, in this encounter between Jesus and the Pharisees, Jesus acts as teacher, trying to explain what is important and why the laws existed in the first place. Rigid adherence to a law can ignore a crucial call for the conversion of heart and practice. Jesus was very clear. No law was to override compassion, forgiveness, and a welcoming inclusion into the community. The gospel moves us to allowing our hearts to experience the outrage of love. It challenges us not to allow tradition or social convention or the expectation of others to hold us back from falling in love with God, with the ideals of the kingdom of heaven, and placing those at the forefront of how we live our lives. It would have been very easy this morning to stand in the pulpit and take a pot shot at the ridiculous traditions and practices that shape our lives as a religious community, and to ask how they demonstrate the love of God to the world. I could quite easily have looked at our concerns about cleanliness and hygiene within a meal of grace. But the readings ask for more. They invite us to be outraged at the ways of our world. They invite us to love outrageously. I started with news that has led to outrage in recent days and want to suggest that we should at times be outraged that these have been the lead stories of news bulletins and papers. While the situation in Calais has remained to the fore, and with the unnecessary loss of life because of illegal trafficking, more people are becoming aware of the story of people leaving the dangers of their homes. The telling of the situations is full of political game-playing and manipulative language, and perhaps we should allow ourselves to experience Jesus' outrage and have that tinge our opinions, that we might demonstrate the outrageous love of the kingdom of heaven. We should be challenging the language of governments and systems where it would seem that colour of skin and nationality decide the legality of your status for entering another country. In a poignant Facebook status on Friday, which was written by a Glasgow student that I don't know, as the number of deaths in a truck in Hungary became apparent and as people were found drowned, this made me cry. According to the UN, the vast majority of refugees have fled from Syria, where an estimated 220,000 to more than 300,000 people have been killed during its appalling and escalating war. The lack of compassion from many Westerners that have been dumbed down by xenophobic narratives in the mainstream media has been appalling. For once in your life, think for yourself. These people are human beings, our brothers and sisters who are in a perilous and desperate situation, largely caused by imperialism, that require urgent assistance. Refugees don't hide their taxes in the Cayman Islands. Refugees don't privatise the National Health Service. Refugees don't influence government cuts to spending. And refugees don't scrape together their life savings, leave their loved ones behind, bribe and fight and struggle their way onto the undercarriage of a train or into a tiny hidden compartment of a lorry with 40 other people. Watch their friends and loved ones die, or get raped, all for the express purpose of bragging about earning £67.46 a week. Imagine waking your children in the morning, feeding and dressing them, putting a little girl's hair into a ponytail, arguing with a little boy about which pair of shoes he wants to wear. Now imagine as you're doing that, you know later today you will strap their vulnerable bodies into the enveloping life jackets and take them with you in a rubber dinghy, through waters which have claimed many who have done the same. Think of the story you'd have to tell to reassure them. Think of trying to make it fun. Consider the emotional strength needed to smile at them and conceal your fear. Try and envisage how it would feel when that experience, your frantic flight from war, was then diminished by a vicious, dishonest media that crudely labelled you and your family migrants, as if you were a scourge on society. Imagine having little to no voice in countering the description of you so commonly used by governments and journalists. How might we engage with the story of refugees? that they might experience the outrageous love of God. Perhaps it begins with taking an interest in challenging the language and recognising even for ourselves that all people matter. The story highlights the inability to respect humanity on a large scale, and it begs us to engage in a concern for humanity within our local community as well. The labels we use to dehumanise and control are to be cast aside in outrage and beyond the poverty, the mental health issue, the bereavement and the brokenness. We are to call with outrageous love to be part of God's beautiful creation and assure humanity, all of humanity, that it is loved. Amen.